Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute of Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and our friends here at WKAR Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, Associate Director for the Institute. I'm joined, as always, by MSU economist Dr. Charlie Ballard and our Institute Director, Dr. Matt Grossman. Later on, we'll be joined by our guest, Dr. Catherine Strunk, a professor of education policy and the Clifford E. Erickson Distinguished Chair in Education here at Michigan State. She is also co-director of the MSU Education Policy Innovation Collaborative, otherwise known as EPIC, and an associate editor of the journal Education, Finance, and Policy. Dr. Strunk will be discussing recent research done jointly by EPIC and IPSR that looked at how all 50 states have approached K-12 education during the pandemic. And certainly an important topic. We'll be looking forward to hearing from Dr. Strunk. But before we speak to Dr. Strunk, Charlie and Matt, quite a bit of news this week. A bit of the state opened up just in time for Memorial Day weekend. Imagine that. We have massive flooding going on in Midland. Our thoughts out to the folks in Midland County. And of the more mundane topics and events that took place was the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference, which is held twice a year, but this time around might be held three times a year. And this is a conference where the House Fiscal Agency in Michigan, the Senate Fiscal Agency, then the Department of Treasurer come to consensus on revenues for the state in the coming months. As we all know and all have read, it is not a pretty picture in this fiscal year or the next two. And before we get into the discussion, I just want to go over some of these figures. So this is from the original revenue estimate given in January of 2020. Over the next 4.5 months for the remainder of this fiscal year, 2020, we have to find $1.9 billion in general fund to cut and $1.2 billion in school aid fund to cut. In fiscal year 2021, which the legislature will no doubt be discussing at the same time they discuss revisions for FY20, the amount is another $1.9 billion cut in general fund and another $1.1 billion cut in school aid fund. And even in fiscal year 2022, while the state will see some growth according to the economics that were used, there'll be a cut of $1.3 billion in general fund and $700 million in school aid fund. Now, this is a little mollified by the fact that we do have some money in the bank right now. But the fact of the matter is that this is unprecedented, as it was pointed out. It's double the rescissions that have had to be made back in the Great Recession, and really without precedent. So, Charlie, I'll turn to you as our economist here on the show at the university and well-known across the state. I know that you've probably been poring over various economic forecasts over the last several weeks. What's your take on these numbers and for Michigan moving forward?
Well, I think the people who put together the numbers, and frankly, some of them are former students of mine, very dedicated professionals, but they would all admit that there's more uncertainty about these revenue estimates than there usually is because of the highly uncertain situation that we find ourselves in with the coronavirus. There's uncertainty about the path of the contagion. And then on top of that, there's uncertainty about the way in which people and businesses will respond to it. So I think they've done, they've done a professional job. This is, these seem like, unfortunately, they seem like reasonable estimates to me. There has been a little, there are little glimmers in recent days. In the last week or so, that maybe things won't be quite as bad, but I don't think we can count on it. And if the revenue situation turns out to be truly as bad as these forecasts suggest, first of all, I think I would use the rainy day fund, which is a little bit more than a billion. If this isn't a rainy day, I don't think we'll ever see a rainy day. But The really big variable is what the federal government does. A lot of money has been issued to the states, but with lots of strings attached, lots of restrictions on how it can be spent. If the money that's coming to Michigan, which is potentially several billion dollars, if that could be allocated freely by the state, then the pain from this to the state and the local governments would be much less severe. So I'm really hoping that we can get some further movement on the federal side. There's a lot of debate in Washington, and a lot of folks in the Congress are reluctant to budge on this. But I think it would be disastrous with potentially layoffs of teachers, layoffs of police, layoffs of firefighters, and the list goes on, if none of those monies could be used.
The fact of the matter is that Michigan is not the only state in this situation.
Not by any means.
And there is a lot of discussion taking place. I know that there's been legislation introduced on the federal level by congressional Democrats to give another dose of money specifically to states and local governments. Republicans right now seem to be giving a wait and see to this. And within all this mix is an upcoming presidential election. Matt, what's your thoughts on the political take on this in terms of election year politics in the midst of all this, not just the pandemic, but now budgetary situation?
Well, first, on the revenue estimates, we have done some analysis in the past and have found that they're generally pretty good. They're about 1% off on average on the school aid fund, and then about 3% off on the general fund. But they have been off as much as 17% in some years. And I think this is going to be a year, as Charlie said, where we see a lot more difficulty in making these projections. And that's, for the next fiscal year, I think it's even harder to project into the future. But we do have a nice process, and the May numbers do improve on the January numbers fairly substantially, we've found as well. So there is some value in this consensus estimation that we do. In terms of the politics, I think everyone so far is waiting for money from the federal government, like Charlie. The legislative leaders don't seem any more willing to try to make schools cut substantially in the remainder of their fiscal year. I'm not sure how that would even be plausible. And it's just not obvious where the money could come from other than those sources that Charlie mentioned of the rainy day fund and the federal government. The estimates are actually slightly more positive for the following year, but not much better. And so that is going to create a big political situation of how to make cuts in an election year. In terms of what other states are doing, it tends to be the lowest common denominator kinds of policies. It tends to be let's take furloughs, let's stop hiring, let's not let's postpone new infrastructure projects, and so those are the kinds of sort of first things that we do when faced with these kinds of budget cuts. And the reason is that almost everything else that you could do is unpopular.
Yeah, I noticed that budget director here in Michigan, Chris Cole, noted that they could eliminate 12 state agencies and the legislature and still not come close. And even with the possibility of federal money coming in, and I think it is a possibility given it's given the election year, these numbers over the next two plus fiscal years amount to over $6 billion in negative revisions that would have to be made. There's only, Charlie, as you noted, $1 billion in the rainy day fund. There's only so much money from federal sources that we're going to get. Matt, you noted that Senator Shirky, I believe it was the other day, said he felt that schools, K-12 schools in Michigan should receive no more cuts for this fiscal year. He didn't mention anything about the next fiscal years. This is an unprecedented situation to manage. And I saw before we came on air here, the report that unemployment in April was 22.7% in Michigan. Even as our state begins to open up, if we begin to see an increase in the virus again, another wave, we'll go back to closure again. So these spikes that we're liable to have in positive for the economy or negative for the economy could very well continue, couldn't they, Charlie?
I think they certainly could. I have to say that I am cautiously optimistic that the federal government will budge some on this issue, because I saw last night Senator Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, and he was making a talking point that is popular among Republican officials lately, which is that the fiscal problems of states, it's those fiscally profligate blue states, whereas the responsible red states don't have much of a problem. That's really not very accurate. All 50 states are in tough shape fiscally, some worse than others, but there isn't a single red state that isn't where the governor and the legislature are not calling up their representatives in Congress and saying, you got to do something about this. So I'm hopeful that political pressure will eventually come through. Otherwise, you know, we're faced with some very difficult choices. And remember, as you said, we've only got a few months left in the fiscal year. And so if something isn't forthcoming soon, it's almost too late. I mean, Governor Whitmer is going to be forced into some very tough cuts. And if the feds deliver some money in the middle of September, that's not good enough for this fiscal year. So action has to happen relatively soon. It is good to see that some parts of our economy are beginning to open up somewhat more. And I think people are getting used to the fact that, okay, well, I'm going to go about my business often wearing a mask when I leave the house. But turns out that's not all that not nearly as fearsome as some might have suggested it would be.
Yeah. You noted in previous mentions, Charlie, Michigan's economy was not doing as well nationally over the last year moving into this.
That's right. We had slowed down in 2017 and 2018 and then slowed down even further in 2019, so that our economy was not far from the edge of a recession already. Of course, the recession was caused by something that we didn't anticipate, but we weren't going gangbusters. I guess one silver lining is, at least, even though we weren't going gangbusters in 2019, at least this is coming at the end of the longest economic expansion in American history. If this virus had arrived in the winter of 2009, it would have been the economic effects would have been even worse.
Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, not to be too cynical, but there is a political situation regarding the cuts, because it's another area where the governor has almost complete power to make these mid-year rescissions, and the legislature could have an incentive to want her to be the one to lay out those cuts. And even if the federal government does come to the rescue, let it appear that Whitmer was willing to make the cuts and Trump came to the rescue. So watch out for the politics surrounding this situation.
Matt, certainly you are not suggesting that those folks in the legislature who have railed for their entire adult lives about how bloated and wasteful and fraudulent and abusive the government is, that they actually want somebody else to make the cuts? Is that what you're saying? Holy smokes.
Matt, I thought I was poking Charlie, not you.
Well, they still will have the backup of saying that, like they have for the emergency powers, that that they would like to be involved in the situation, but that they can't be,
and they really don't want to be. So with that, let's turn to Dr. Strunk and her work in the area of K-12 education, which of course was of primary importance as the stay-home orders took effect and continues to be at the top of the discussion list in Michigan's capital and state capitals and local communities across the country. As I noted, Dr. Strunk is a co-director at MSU's Education Policy Innovation Collaborative and recently led an effort to provide a searchable database of K-12 education actions taken by states as schools closed. Welcome, Dr. Strunk.
Thanks for having me.
Could you talk a bit about this research and the database that's been developed?
Yeah, happy to. And you know, I should note that this was a joint effort between IPSR, where you all are, and EPIC. I think our first official joint effort, and hopefully not our last. And in it, we track states' somewhat early responses in K-12 public education to the COVID crisis. So I think our last update was April 24th. And we went through and searched all the legislation that had been proposed to date, what the kind of executive orders and other kind of policy responses had been to COVID with respect to K-12 public schools. So we found a number of things. We found that it was clear that no state was prepared for the necessary transition to remote instruction, which we wouldn't have expected them to be. No one was prepared to think about why we would be having to immediately go overnight almost to kids not inside face-to-face instruction inside of the school building. But we did see substantial variation in how states were addressing the crisis. So we saw differences in whether or not districts were required to make up all lost instructional hours, whether they could forgive those hours or just allow for replacement hours. We saw substantial variation across states, just what they were requiring of districts in terms of the level of planning that they were doing to for having their districts address education for their kids. So 29 states, including Michigan, required districts to plan distance learning options for students. Another 16 encouraged it, but did not require. The majority of states provided some resources to districts for distance learning, but just not that much, and or sometimes not at all. Most states acknowledged that remote learning couldn't just be solely offered online, and they varied in what they required for other options. There's been a lot of concern in the conversation about equity, and particularly for kids with special education services, and so we saw some variation and differences across the states about what states are requiring for and even offering for kids who have IEPs or 504 plans. And then, of course, assessments. Everyone got a waiver from the federal government to not do standardized tests this spring. And there are sort of some confusion, it seems, about what states and districts should do about grading at all. So some states are suggesting pass-fail. Some states are suggesting that districts ask for content mastery and evidence of that. Some states are saying just kind of graduate and advance students depending on wherever they were on March 11th or whenever school shut down. So that's the kind of data that we have. It is searchable and on our website, and we think it's we're hopeful that it can be used as states try to think about what some best practices might be going forward.
And Catherine, you also prepared a sort of a rush version of the research summary that might be useful to states undergoing this transition. What were the big lessons from research on distance learning and on trying to make this transition?
So I think, again, no one had done this before, right? We'd never had to sort of rush into suddenly educating kids in this fashion. And so there's no research that says, you know, when you have a pandemic and kids are facing all sorts of trauma and all these other ways, here's what you should do and here are the best practices. But we tried to think about this from the research perspective of just what do we know? And some things that we know are that seat time matters. And so there's a lot of evidence that tells us the more time kids are in school with quality teachers and quality instruction, they're learning more. And so having them out from school, not just for the summer months, but you already are, you know, there's a well-known summer slide that happens between the spring and the fall. And now you're having them out for another two plus months where they're not getting, even if they're getting some schooling, and I think teachers in schools and districts are trying very hard to provide education to their kids, it's not the same level and same degree and same intensity of the schooling they would be getting otherwise. And so NWA actually, which is a testing company, a nonprofit that does formative tests for a lot of different districts and states, showed from some recent research the kind of degree of summer, or what they're calling the COVID slide, that will happen when you have kids out of traditional classrooms from sometime in March through, you know, at the earliest September or late August. And it shows pretty drastic reductions in terms of what we should expect kids to know when they come back to school in the fall, if they come back to school in the fall. And these losses are, of course, particularly acute for economically disadvantaged students in schools. So there is research that suggests that academically oriented programs offered during these kinds of, you know, summer months or long time away from school can really help improve educational outcomes for these kids, especially for low-income students. And one of the things that seems to be most important in literature is continuing the connection between the student's teacher and the student him or herself. And so having this kind of personal interaction, whether it be a phone call or feedback on work, or, you know, some kids are doing Zoom calls, or even just some sort of check-in with teachers, seems to be very important for maintaining satisfaction and engagement and decreasing the risk of dropout from these programs. There's also some really good information about how to help teachers develop the competencies they need to teach in this kind of fashion. And so they're kind of the three areas of knowledge that we try to give teachers in PD have, you know, content knowledge, pedagogical knowledge, and technology knowledge. And making sure that we're thinking a lot about the latter two, especially how does pedagogy change in a remote environment? And what do we have to help teachers understand about technology to be able to instruct kids remotely is, I think, a critical thing that we should be thinking a lot about this summer as we're gearing up for probably some, at least planning for some hybrid version of schooling to happen in the fall.
It makes me wonder, looking to the longer term, Catherine, about whether whether we've got the right length of school year. Lots of affluent countries have a longer school year than we have here in the United States. And if what you said, that time in the seat matters, that would suggest to me that after the COVID-19 crisis has passed, or even before, we should be thinking about how we want to configure the instructional calendar in 2022 and beyond.
I think that's a really important consideration, and I think it's one that a lot of states are tackling right now. North Carolina has already added on 5 days to their school year next year and said they're going to start a week early. I think most states are still kind of in a wait and see because they're not sure what it's going to even look like by August and September when they could be going back to school. But we're, you know, the way that we originally set up our school year, I'm not an education historian, but I think we all know, is that we had this long break for summer because that was the agrarian society and we had to have, you know, kids helping out in the fields. Well, we don't really have that across the whole country any longer. And there's a good reason to think you'd want a balanced calendar just to even avoid the summer slide that we've already talked about, have less time away from school and think about balancing over the course of the calendar year in ways that would help to make up time. There's also a lot of conversation around an extended school day. And so I don't know if you all saw, but West Bloomfield came out just this week with their proposed plan for the fall. And in it, they say they're going to have kids come back for 2 days a week each inside the buildings, and then 2 days a week or 3 days a week with remote instruction. And you could think about, well, would it make sense to have a longer school day for the days that they're actually inside the classroom to be able to get more one-on-one FaceTime with their teachers, to be able to think about how you could use those days when you do have kids in the classroom and you do have kids getting more traditional kinds of instruction to extend what they can actually do.
Well, it makes me wonder too, as we move into these different into these discussions on different formats like the West Bloomfield, what will happen to the co-curricular activities such as art and music and the athletics that are a part of the high school experience as well. So
I think it's really important, and I think one of the things that I think the pandemic has made incredibly clear is that schools are about more than just core instruction. They're about giving food to poor kids who need it. They're about giving, you know, social services to kids who need it. Any kind of these interventions that are not being provided by other groups are happening through schools. Recreation, physical activity, these are things that are really important that kids are getting at school that they're not able to get as much in the home environment. So there's going to be a lot of consideration, I hope, about how do we provide the suite of things that schools are responsible for in a world in which the kids can only be in school potentially half time.
Yeah, it's a great point, Catherine. The school as the true community center. So,
you know, sometimes you get a kind of a synergy between two rather different groups of people who have a common interest. And I know folks on Governor Whitmer's Small Business Advisory Commission, and they say that the number one priority for small businesses in large parts of Michigan is universal web access, high-speed internet all across the state. And I've heard it's from the same, from a different angle from the educators in, especially in rural areas, where an awful lot of the children do not have internet access. And I'm kind of hopeful that we could put those two groups together for a political push to really, really ramp up our efforts toward getting high-speed internet access for everyone in Michigan.
I think that would be ideal. And I think that that is going to be a core component of any kind of remote instruction going forward. But it's only as good as the quality of the instruction coming over the internet, right? And sure. So if you haven't trained teachers who haven't been taught before how to teach online, how to teach in this kind of way, I mean, I have 2 8-year-olds at home, and trying to look at 26 second graders on a Zoom call is kind of overwhelming. It's almost as bad as a faculty meeting. And you have to think about, teachers have to have a whole new way of teaching over even synchronous or asynchronous remote connections. And so we can just give everyone the internet. That's an important sort of necessary step, but it's definitely not sufficient for providing the kind of high quality instruction we want our kids to get in Michigan.
Yeah. And of course, it's not just about access, it's about having the equipment. My local high school handed out 1,100 Chromebooks as the pandemic ensued, and the state, as part of their online or off-campus instruction plan. But Charlie, I think you're right in that this seems to me to be an issue area where urban legislators and rural legislators could agree on in terms of access, online access to education for their constituents. So again, the political side of this might make for some strange bedfellows.
Well, there is money in the federal bill that passed the House, but is unlikely to pass the Senate, specifically allocated to that, especially in preparation for schools. But I don't know how likely it is to to follow through. Catherine, what should schools be thinking about for the fall? I know one thing that we talked about was they won't have any exams from the spring, and how will they kind of assess where their students are?
Yeah, there's actually kind of in the education world some controversy on this. And so on one hand, you know, you don't want kids to, if they come back to school in the fall in the buildings, you don't want them to come in after all the kind of trauma that they've had and the instructional days lost and have to waste quote unquote time doing assessments and feeling like they're going to be held accountable for things. On the other side, kids are going to have lost learning time and had varying degrees of, you know, retention of what they've been learning over the course of the summer / spring when they weren't in school. And so teachers are going to not know where kids come in even more than usual. Every fall, most schools and districts that I know of do some kind of formative assessment where they say, you know, where are kids starting out so we can help them learn and grow from there. There's no reason that that should be any different this year. And in fact, it's probably more important than ever, just given the broad variation in where kids are going to be. Even, and it's harder to predict from last year's, you know, maybe they have January grades or scores, but they're not going to have the spring test score to really know where kids ended up, or even spring formative scores to know where kids ended up, and then where they would theoretically be able to kind of start in again in the fall. So I think it would be an absolute shame if we didn't figure out a way to do formative assessments in the fall across K-12 to understand where kids are, what they're missing, and what we can do to kind of target instruction and differentiate instruction to them. And it's something that could actually be done really well remotely if you think about it, because while they're in the classroom, they could be almost flipping it, right? So they're learning some things from their teachers, but then they're doing some of the remediation at their time at home to catch them up to where the class is on average.
Well, great information, Catherine. Greatly appreciate the work that you and EPIC do, not just in this area, but many K-12 areas with a lot of important perspectives and work for Michigan policymakers and educators to think about. And now that that database is on your website, I believe, as well as the IPSR website, is it not?
That is correct.
So if people want to go to epicedpolicy.org, or ipsr.msu.edu, they can find that searchable database. Matt, Charlie, any closing thoughts before we end this month's show?
Well, it's been the weirdest 2 months of a lot of people's lives, but at least the flowers and trees are in bloom, and people, as you drive around town, you can see that that more people are getting out. So long as they do that in a sensible way and don't take undue risks to their health and the health of the people around them, we can at least begin the recovery from this stunning economic downturn.
Matt, any closing thoughts?
No, stay healthy. It's a good place to end.
Well, that's all the time we have on this edition of State of the State. My thanks to our co-hosts, Dr. Charlie Ballard and Dr. Mac Grossman, and our guest, Dr. Catherine Strunk. And my thanks also to Russ White and the staff at WKAR for support of this program. Join us again next month on State of the State.